you're like me, you look forward to StoryCorps every Friday morning on NPR's Morning Edition, where you hear powerful first-person narratives by Americans of all backgrounds. StoryCorps started in 2003, and since then has collected and archived more than 30,000 interviews. Each conversation will be preserved at the Library of Congress. And Strainchamps recently caught up with the founder and president of StoryCorps, Dave Isay, in his office in New York City.
I think I'm still pretty surprised by the emotional reaction people have to the pieces. You know, the most common comment we get, and we get dozens if not hundreds of these every week, is people talk about how every Friday morning they cry when they hear StoryCorps, which is interesting because, you know, most of the stories aren't actually sad. But I think that there's something about hearing in this kind of world of commercialism and phoniness that we live in, where everything's kind of an advertisement, everyone's trying to sell you something, except on public radio, of course, that hearing people speaking authentically and speaking from the heart about their lives is something that's very powerful for people. And I also think that in many cases, that the stories that we play are really people talking about humanity at its best. I mean, it's often people bringing someone to the booth who's kind of an angel in their life, who they're honoring. And in hearing these stories of kind of everyday people's kind of courage and kindness and so forth, it's almost sort of, I guess, walking on holy ground. And that becomes a very emotional experience for people. So even the funny stories have people crying. So that's been unexpected, very strange, but, you know, it's wonderful.
Can we hear an example? There's a story, I think you brought this one, with Kim Emerson and Gladys Chen.
I actually haven't heard this story in many years, but this is a woman named Kim Emerson whose sister, Kendra Webdale, was pushed in front of a subway by a mentally ill individual. And they ended up creating a law called Kendra's Law that had to do with making sure that folks were stable before they were released from psychiatric institutions. And she had a chance to sit down with her friend Gladys and talk about the day she found out about her sister.
I was at home and I got a phone call from actually a reporter or a journalist from the New York Post. And I just let it ring. I was just screening my calls. And she said, "Are you the sister of Kendra Webdale?" And so I heard that and I like hopped up to go get the phone. She said, "That was killed on the subway." And like as soon as I heard the word killed, I went to a different place, a place that I've never been before, that I felt like I was kind of out of myself. I never knew what going into shock was, and now when I look back, it was definitely that type of feeling, but I just remember falling on the floor, and I was just screaming. I was making noises that I didn't even know I was capable of, because there's nothing in my life that ever made me scream like that or make a noise like that. And I actually later, I must have been eating an Oreo because there was Oreo like all over the floor. And the worst part about the whole day was knowing that I had to tell my family. And I remember standing by my bed and thinking to myself, right now, they don't know. Like right now, life is good. And I'm going to tell them something so horrible that's going to change their lives. And I don't want to do it. And I just remember like waiting, just minutes, knowing I had to, but just waiting to give them more moments of peace. And there was one voice message that Kendra had miraculously left on. I had the old answering machines and there was a little tape in it. And there was a full message from Kendra.
It's Kendra. It's Monday night at about 10.
I know every inflection in her voice. So she's actually talking on it and talking for like a couple minutes. And in the end, she's like, "Okay, bye. I love you.
I love you. Talk to you later. Bye."
That is the one thing that I have with her voice on it. And it's one of the most valuable things that I could ever have.
That story really does break your heart. I mean, I can't imagine being the StoryCorps employee in the booth listening to and transcribing it. The first time I heard it, I had to stop and cry and then call my own sister. What do you do and what does it do to you to witness a story like that?
I know the facilitators tell me that often at the end of the day, many of the interviews are about parents, you know, or with parents. And often at the end of the day, facilitators will get on the phone and call their parents, their mom or their dad, and just say, you know, I love you or I'm thinking about you. So that's kind of a common reaction to both being in the booth and, I guess, listening to stories as well.
Kim's story is an example of a story from the traveling StoryCorps booth, but you've also sought out specific stories as well. You have a September 11th initiative. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. StoryCorps is a general oral history project. We're all over the country recording everybody's stories. But we also early on decided that it was important to take on some special initiatives to ensure that we could collect important stories around specific issues or groups. And the first special initiative we took on was the September 11th initiative. It's still going on. And that is in partnership with the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, where we're working to collect one story to honor everyone who was killed on September 11th, 2001. And, you know, when StoryCorps started, I had a sense that we would see a lot of folks who were dealing with illness or end-of-life issues coming to StoryCorps when they could, and that's something we did see. But what didn't occur to me was that we would see a lot of people come to StoryCorps to honor people who had died. And, you know, one of the interesting things about these 9/11 interviews is that, you know, we'll see firefighters come to StoryCorps who haven't talked about their experiences before and will come to the booth and cry. And, you know, would never consider going to a therapist because they would think of it as self-indulgent, but something about leaving this record for history gives them the license to come in and talk about their experiences. I think we have one clip here to play, and this is John Vigiano, who came to StoryCorps to remember his sons, John Jr., who was a firefighter, and Joe, who was a policeman, and they both died at the World Trade Center, and John did come in by himself.
There were a couple of days each year you were allowed to take your children to work. And Joe loved it. That was his birthday present, that he would come and spend the night in the firehouse. We'd have a cake, and the guys I work with, they would take a milk container, and they'd cut out the facsimile of a building, and they'd put it on the top of the cake, and then they would light it up. And they would tell Joe to put it out, and he would throw a pot of water on it. The birthday cake was a little soggy, but this is what he wanted. Joe started dating a young lady whose father was a police officer, and he come home one day and he says, I'm taking a police test. I says, Joe, you're only 17 years old. He says, no big deal. He passed the test, and when he graduated, they assigned him to East New York, where I started my career. On the other side of the room, my son, John, wanted nothing to do with police or emergency service or fire department. He wanted to be the next Donald Trump. He was going to make $1 million and take care of his mother and father. But in 1984, I came down with throat cancer. He noticed then how my unit took care of us, and he says, I'm going to become a fireman. I says, you're kidding me. Firemen don't make millions of dollars. How am I going to live like a king? But I was very happy, very proud. My father had been on the fire department, and he was the first one to be issued badge number 3436. And when John decided he wanted to be a firefighter, they reissued it to my son, John. So the badge was only used by two. Both the boys would call me when they were working. John would always call around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And that particular night, September 10th, we spoke for a few minutes. And I says, I love you. And he says, I love you. Joe called me in the morning and told me to turn on the television that a plane just hit the Trade Center. He says, I'm heading south on West Street. This is a big one. And I just said, be careful. I love you. He said, I love you too. That was it. We had the boys for John for 36 years, Joe for 34 years. Ironically, badge number 3436. I don't have any could've, should've, or would've. I wouldn't have changed anything. There's not many people that the last words they said to their son or daughter was, I love you. And the last words they heard was, I love you. So that makes me sleep at night.
David, you waited until about 2005 to start the September 11th issue. Why wait more than 4 years after the event? And why not record these stories right after they were happening?
We are not a first responder project. You know, when something tragic and terrible happens, like September 11th or Katrina, you know, the first needs are basic needs having to do with survival and food and water and so forth.
You don't want to get in the way.
That's not us, yeah. And we don't want to get in the way, and that is not a place we can be of service. So we found that StoryCorps is much better suited after people have a chance to take a breath. You know, it's a project where you really do have a chance to stop and take a deep breath and look at each other and in this kind of silence of the booth, you know, have these conversations. And as you know and can imagine, that in the wake of a disaster or tragedy, silence isn't really the operative word.
The September 11th initiative isn't the only kind of disaster-related initiative. You also went to New Orleans to record stories about Hurricane Katrina.
Yep.
How did that come about?
You know, it's the same sort of thing. I mean, I think it was a year, maybe a little bit longer than a year after Katrina, and we went down. It was a smaller initiative. We're actually down in Louisiana again doing BP interviews right now. Yes, we went down when we felt that it was appropriate for us to be down and record these stories, and we did, I believe, several hundred interviews with families who were impacted by Katrina, both in Louisiana and Mississippi and elsewhere.
Hmm. Can we hear one?
Sure. This is a man named Douglas DeSilvi, who came to StoryCorps to talk about losing his wife and daughter and mother-in-law in Hurricane Katrina.
My name is Douglas Paul DeSilvi. I'm a native of the Gulf Coast. The story I want to tell today is about my family. The three women in my family have steered my life for the past 59 years to the man that I am today, and I hope and think that I am a pretty good fellow. Every time we had a hurricane, we would all go over to Nadine's home. We consider this just another storm. Since 77, when she built this house, we've been through every storm in it, not knowing what we were in for. We were sitting on the bed, and I could hear glass breaking, and I walked to the back of her bedroom, which was facing the bay, just to measure the water to see how high up it was. And in the back, the water just came up so fast, it was unbelievable. As I turned and told them to hold hands, that we was going to have to get into the water, the roof came down on all of us. And my lungs started filling up with water, and I just kept asking Jesus not to let me go like this. I had to get my family out. I got out, and they didn't. I'm a big guy. I'm 268 pounds. And I exercise and stay healthy. And I could not do a thing. It was just their time to go. The only way I can understand this. Losing a family is, I don't think there's any words for it. Kind of makes you wonder what life's all about. Many, many questions I have not received answers for yet. I just don't know what I feel these days. I wake up and go to my office and do my job, and I come home. I've got the house full of their belongings, and that I don't know what to do about. You know, when as a father and a dad and a husband and everything, you always plan for the future of everybody, and it's just the opposite now. I have nobody to plan for or work on retirement for or save for buying a house, or it's just me.
That one's so hard to listen to.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I think that people who record these stories, you know, we know from talking to people after they've done these interviews that it becomes very important to them to have a chance to have these conversations and to leave a record of what happened and make sure that they feel like they've been heard.
Does it help people to tell their stories? I mean, do they feel better after they walk out of the booth having just told a story like that?
In my experience, the answer is, you know, uniformly yes. I mean, they don't come to the booth unless they want to tell these stories. I think it's cathartic. I think it's extremely important to people. You know, if you're talking about something like the 9/11 project, you know, leaving a record, it's not a record of what happened on 9/11 only. You know, it's a record of who, you know, their brother, their son, their father, their mother was as a person. We hear at StoryCorps very often that people talking about how the 40 minutes in the booth is, you know, among the most important 40 minutes they've spent in their life often. We're starting a end-of-life initiative called Legacy Initiative, people who are dealing with death and dying. And a man named Ira Byock, who's a great palliative care doctor, came to StoryCorps to talk to us last week. And he wrote a book about the four things to say before you die, which are thank you, forgive me, I forgive you, and I love you. That's something that palliative care folks suggest that people say who are facing end-of-life issues. But I think it's, you know, I think it's the kind of conversation that's important for us all to have because we're all, in one way or another, facing the end of our lives. And if you think about that John Vigiano clip, the importance of having the last thing that he ever said to his children be, I love you, which is just such a profound and important and true message.
David Isay is founder and president of StoryCorps, and Strange Champ spoke with him.